Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition, Friday filmmaker series edition, Friday filmmaker series Casey edition.
Yay!
Casey's back.
Glad to be back.
Welcome.
I just shook the table.
That's all right.
That's how excited I am. Thanks for having me again. I always look forward to these.
Yeah, man. So to catch everyone up, we started a Casey on Kubrick series, which... by the way, and that has now borne many filmmaker series.
I noticed. I just listened to the first Paul Thomas Anderson episode.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the rest of those.
Yeah, Adam's great.
But it was great to, especially that first film that
Heart
is so
Eight.
Underseen. So
I figured
yeah.
you'd be all over that
oh,
movie.
Yeah.
So we did several Kubrick movies. We did The Shining. We did Paths of Glory. We did Barry Lyndon. We did Eyes Wide Shut.
And Full Metal Jacket.
Wow, so we did five.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
And then you made the decision to do a little switcheroo.
Just a little detour.
And do a movie of something sort of inspired by Kubrick.
Yeah.
And it was a film that I had not seen, Jonathan Glazer's Birth.
Yes.
I remember this movie coming out. I was a huge fan of Sexy Beast.
Ooh.
So I don't know why I didn't see this. I didn't see Under the Skin yet either.
Oh, wow.
Is that
yeah.
good?
Oh, it's, yeah. It's
so he's one of your guys.
It's probably his best film so
oh,
far,
really?
I would say.
Wow.
I don't know. Between this and Birth, or between Birth and... Under the Skin, it's hard to say. I probably still favor Birth a little bit, but
Sexy Beast is number three.
Yeah,
I love that movie.
I mean, it's a great movie, but
okay.
But I think he really takes off with Birth and Under the Skin.
So what? I don't know much about this guy. What's his deal?
He comes from commercials and music videos primarily.
Okay,
and he still does a lot of that work today because you can see like Sexy Beast comes out in 2000, Birth 2004, and then he doesn't make another feature until Under the Skin in 2013.
Yeah.
So he's kind of Kubrick-like in that way that
for sure.
he has these long stretches of time. And on Wikipedia now, there's something called like Untitled Jonathan Glazer Project.
Well, that's what
for
I just
2020.
Looked up.
So
2020.
You know, he's averaging about one a decade.
Jeez.
You know, and I think he takes a similar approach to Kubrick in that because he has this other living that he's making off of advertising and music videos and so on, he can just kind of pick his spots and take as many years as he wants to kind of find the right story and also do a lot of the kind of technical research and refinement that Kubrick did as well.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research into Birth and saw that, you know, there were dozens of versions of this script,
yes.
including page one rewrites.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is just like, that's tough.
Yeah. So you can tell he obviously cares a lot about getting it right
mm-hmm.
on the page before you ever get committed to shooting something.
Yeah, and Birth was and is a very, very polarizing film.
It is, yeah.
It got very famously booed at Venice.
Yes.
If you go on, you know, these aggregate sites, aggregators,
yeah.
like Rotten Tomatoes.
What is it, Metacritic, 30-something, 50-something?
I think Rotten Tomatoes is like 38 or 40.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
But Metacritic is like 50-50.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
right down
yeah.
the middle.
Yeah.
And after seeing it, it's sort of no wonder. Like, I really liked it. But I can see how it is not everyone's cup of tea.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's kind of an absurd premise played super straight.
Super straight.
And so either you accept that and you go with it and you find that compelling to see
yeah.
how would these kind of, you know, educated adults, reasonable people react to this kind of absurd situation
mm-hmm.
As opposed to I think some people just kind of are like, what, this is nonsense and kind of, you know, tune out.
Yeah, so just some people listen to these and haven't seen the movie. So to just give everyone just to sort of the briefest of overviews, the premise of the film is that at the very beginning of the movie, you just see, and we'll talk about that shot in a minute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But a jogger dies, and you hear a little bit of voiceover from this jogger, and it turns out that is the husband of Nicole Kidman.
Yep.
We pick up 10 years later, and a boy, a 10-year-old boy, well, you see a baby get born.
Yeah, you do see a baby get born.
Very key.
Yeah.
And that baby grows up, ostensibly that baby grows up to be this boy named Sean. Her former husband's name was Sean.
Yep.
And Sean enters Nicole Kidman's life. She's about to be married. She's engaged to Danny Houston's character. Love me some Danny Houston.
Oh, he's terrific.
He's
in
great.
This, yeah.
And claims to be her dead husband. And then what happens from there is the movie.
Yeah. And I think you can watch the whole film and kind of come away with, you know, different ideas of what really happened, which I think is interesting, too. And that's probably another reason why, you know, people are somewhat divided on it.
Yeah.
Not that it's necessarily an open ending. I feel like the film actually kind of goes maybe a little too far out of its way to kind
with
of sew things
stuff.
Up. Yeah. But at the same time, that explanation for me is unsatisfying in the whole, because I feel like there were still things that he knew, a sense mm-hmm. that he had of who this family was uh-huh. and so on, some of the kind of tertiary characters that I would be really surprised that he could have gleaned all that just from some letters
yeah.
between two lovers. So I to
oh,
me,
is that
it's
the
still,
implication?
Yeah, the implication is that he saw the letters that Anne Heche buried and
right.
read them and then kind of, you know, internalized all that. That's where he got all his intel from, is sort of the implication.
That flew by me a bit.
But I don't think that explains everything. I think mm-hmm. I think it's kind of enough of an explanation that it allows everybody in the film to kind of mm-hmm. process it and move on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's still like some underlying like supernatural kind of mystery there
yeah.
that, you know, is sort of beyond logic or reason.
Yeah, and there's also, since you bring up supernatural, part of the problem I think people had with this movie is that it's hard to pin down genre.
Yeah, sure.
Because I've seen it described as a thriller,
which
is really not.
Yeah, I think
it was
Ebert
sort of,
called it a thriller, and I was
well,
just
it was
like,
kind
yeah.
of marketed as such.
Yeah, of course.
I've seen it labeled as a bit of a horror thing.
Yeah,
it's not really that.
Not really. No.
I've seen it labeled as a fantasy.
But it's so anchored
fairy
in
fairy tale
reality, you know.
Yeah, and it's hard. And I think I love the Glazers of the world because they don't he's clearly not, and like Kubrick too, not trying to put something in a tidy little box.
Yes.
And something that he's okay with confounding an audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what happened here.
Yeah. I think a lot of credit too has to go to one of the screenwriters, Jean-Claude Carrier,
mm-hmm.
who worked a lot with Louis Buñuel during his like French period. Buñuel is known as a surrealist,
mm-hmm.
somebody who was commenting on the real world and politics
yeah.
and a very kind of provocative filmmaker in his own way, but doing it through this kind of surrealist, absurdist kind of situation where
right.
you just have a lot of times, I mean, his films tend to center around like the world of wealthy people
uh-huh.
and their kind of weird parlor games and,
right.
you know, personal dramas and
very
so on.
Very Kubrickian as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's always commenting on class quite a bit in his films, and but doing it through this kind of absurd lens. And
right.
I think this film does something very similar, except that I think it has more of an emotional kind of resonance. There's more kind of care given to the actual kind of feelings up on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and the audience kind of, I think, identifies way more with the characters in Birth than
right.
the kind of nameless, faceless bourgeoisie that you see in like the Buñuel films.
Yeah, for sure. I will say that I love the movie.
Yeah,
I haven't
yeah.
even said that yet.
So I was wondering. I was kind of like, it's like, man, am I going to go in there having to play defense or what's going on? Because it is, you know.
I just went into it eyes wide open.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like you said, you sort of need to buy the premise,
right?
And buy that it's played straight.
Yeah.
And not sit there and go, but what about? And
yes.
I didn't do that. I just watched it and loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, even though there are numerous similarities to Kubrick's films, and I'm sure we'll get into all that,
mm-hmm.
For all that, it still doesn't feel necessarily like a Kubrick film in
no.
all respects. I think, again, some of the emotional character of it, the performances,
yeah.
I think you can get quite emotionally involved in this one, whereas I think Kubrick tends to maintain a little bit more of a icy kind of distance.
That's true, although I will say that there was some ice in this movie. I think I'm thinking more
Lauren,
in terms
Lauren
of
Bacall or
well, Lauren yeah. Bacall, and then not even the performances, just sort of these the apartment and
yes.
the apartment building. It all felt very Stanley Kubrick with this just very cold marble, not overly adorned.
Yes,
there's a distance there. It wasn't a warm movie.
Yeah, no, that's very true. But I still think like he tends to use a few more close-ups. He tends to kind of, I don't know. I find I'm totally with Nicole Kidman as I watch this, and yeah. I really do feel her kind of internal struggle and her kind of knowing on the one hand rationally there's no way that this can be true, but emotionally right. feeling that it is true anyway.
And wanting it to be true,
yeah,
which he flat
absolutely.
Out says at one
absolutely.
Point, you know, I wanted it to be Sean.
And I think ultimately like it is a film about love. It's a film about kind of the unknowability of the other person mm-hmm. in that relationship
yep.
that it is so much based on projection on what we think that person is or
yeah.
means to somebody. And it's almost like the boy, Sean, is like, he is that projection of Nicole Kidman's mm-hmm. feelings about her late husband,
mm-hmm.
whereas the reality, which is more represented by the Ian Hache character, is a little more complicated
mm-hmm.
and not so pure and cut and dry.
Right.
But Sean is sort of that, the boy, is sort of that pure, you know, good intentioned,
mm-hmm.
never strayed, never, you know, meant anything wrong kind of character. And,
yeah.
and so it's like, and then when it comes later to when the boy has to explain how he's not her husband,
right.
all he can say is something that sounds absurd on its face, which is that I'm not your husband because I love you. Something
right.
like to that effect.
Yeah, because the whole conceit at the end is Ian Hache reveals that she was a lover.
Yeah.
And
that they'd carried on this like long affair.
Yeah, and was his real true love.
Yes.
So if you were Sean, you would have come to see me.
Yeah.
Not Anna? Yeah, Anna.
Yeah.
And so that's what he says at the end. He said, I can't be Sean because I love you.
Yeah.
And
she says,
her.
That makes no sense. And he says, I'm sorry. That's the best I can explain it. Because he doesn't want to shatter that love that she has for
yeah.
her late husband by revealing what happened.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
so, and that's sort of what the Ian Hache character is planning on doing at the beginning of the film
mm-hmm.
when she comes with all those letters in the box
mm-hmm.
to the party, to the kind of engagement announcement.
Mm-hmm.
I think she wants to sort of free her from that
mm-hmm.
that baggage that she's carrying around, that she's still kind of carrying a torch. She's still going to his grave, it seems like somewhat regularly, and still kind of,
yeah.
you know, the Danny Houston character talks a lot about how throughout their relationship, he's had to kind of deal with this other presence
yeah.
of this, you know, this lost love that
yeah, yeah.
she still has real affection for. And yet she feels the need to move on. But at the same time, there's always going to be that part of her that kind
yeah.
of belongs to this other guy. And
that's like kind of the big question, though,
yeah.
right? About all of us.
Yes.
Is, there's situations of people in my family, and there was another one I just read about where it was the big thing that went around the internet about the World War II veteran who had the French girlfriend.
Oh, I don't know
this
story.
Who he hadn't seen in 70,
yeah.
Or they're like 75
right.
years
yeah,
or
yeah,
something,
yeah.
and they were reunited. But it's that whole thing of, and this happened a lot in that generation where your husband would go off to war and maybe never come back.
Exactly, yeah.
And you'd just pick up and move on and find
yeah,
someone else.
Yeah.
But that is the big question of all of us, if we believe in a destined partner or that there is only one, like how do you move on from, like you find that person, that's the hardest thing in the world,
sort of
then
the
they die young.
And then, yeah.
And like what do you do from there?
Yeah.
How do you move on?
Yeah, exactly. How do you move on? I mean, it gets to the core of like, do we think there is just one person
right.
that is, you know, destined to be right for you, or are relationships more of like work and,
right.
and compromise and negotiation
right.
and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it's something that, you know, you don't just luck into meeting the person that
right.
is the exact perfect fit. You
right.
kind of build that with somebody.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting. I think there's also, like in a lot of Kubrick films, in this film there's also the dimension of class, because you see that
yeah.
The Nicole Kidman character, Danny Houston character, they live in this kind of
mm-hmm.
very affluent, old money world of New York high society.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean, the boy, is clearly from a much more like working class background. Like his parents
yeah.
are educated.
Right.
His dad's like a piano tutor or something.
Buffalo Bill.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But his dad
has the line though. At one point, he said something like, "They have money."
Yeah, that's literally like the only description he gives.
But
he's like, I don't know who these people are, but they've got money. You
did
know?
That feel like a red herring to you the first time?
Oh,
you saw
like
it?
They're going to try to cash in or something?
Yeah,
like there might
like,
be some value.
Because one of the things I loved about the film is, I had no idea where it was going to go. There's a lot of tension in the film because if you buy into it as an audience, you have no there's no telegraphing.
Yes, yeah.
It's a very smartly like plotted out movie to where
you really don't see where it's,
is there a magical element that's going to happen where all of a sudden it's big and she says the magic words and he turns into Sean?
Right.
Or are his parents fleecing him?
Yeah.
Or like, is he going to fucking kill her or something?
Yeah.
I had no idea where it was going.
Yeah. So I don't know. To me, I didn't feel it like a red herring, but it is sort of only brought up that one time.
Right.
Although you see it a little bit also with Anne Heche and the Peter Stormare character.
Yeah.
That couple, they also seem to be slightly less moneyed. And I think
who is Sean's brother.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So she was having an affair with her brother's husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or not her, with her brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law, yeah. And so I think you can kind of see a lot of things going on class-wise where if you assume that the late Sean was kind of similar to his brother, mm-hmm. he was probably marrying up by being with Nicole Kidman.
Right, because it was her money.
Yes.
Because Lauren Bacall is her mother.
Right.
And
she lives with her mother.
The house on Long Island.
Yeah.
And she has the big apartment.
Right,
and,
right. Yeah. And something similar is going on, I think, even a step up that's happening from Nicole Kidman to Danny Houston. Because when you see Nicole Kidman at work, she's like one of many at a kind of a conference room table.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of come in and let her know that her sister had, you know, given birth.
Right.
Then at the end of the film,
when she meets with him.
Yeah, in the boardroom. And it's kind of like he seems like he kind of owns that room, you know?
He's alone at a 40-person conference table.
Yes, yes. And she goes as far as to kind of get down on her knee and like embrace his hand. And it's this real like mea culpa kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it does feel like she's also moving up the kind of ladder in that way. And it's almost like the marriage of her to him,
mm-hmm.
there's a dimension of it's not purely based on love. It's also based on security. It's mm-hmm. based on like this is going to set me up to have like the rest of my life be kind of solid and, mm-hmm. and taken care of and provide for, you know, us to start a family or whatever. So I think there's also that tension in there.
Yeah.
As there is in a lot of Kubrick too.
I think there was the original Sean, OG Sean, who we never see.
Right.
We only had that one brief voiceover, was a scientist.
Yeah, and he was lecturing at hospitals and whatnot.
So I see why he made him a scientist because it sort of fits with the fact that like – because he even says at the very beginning, talks about reincarnation, the fact that he does not believe that.
Yeah.
But I think it might have had a little more of impact had he been more blue collar even.
True, yeah.
And like her true love – was a fucking like high school teacher.
Yeah. That's true.
But
I mean, he's giving.
I'm not
going
to knock it for that. But.
Yeah, I mean, he's giving like guest lectures. It doesn't sound like he was like
he's not
tenured,
a big money
scientist. you know, like big
sure.
name in the field.
Yeah, he wasn't a wealthy guy, probably.
Right.
But
very smart. But
so maybe that
you know,
was the middle ground
from like humble kind of beginnings, probably.
Touching on that scene you just talked about, though, when she goes to him at the end and gets on her knees, I thought that scene was so real.
Yeah.
Because she she flat out says, like, you know, what was I supposed to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how could I have done anything else?
Right.
I couldn't send that boy away.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he sits there, and again, I still didn't know what was going to happen, and he considers it because she basically is like, can we just move on and have our life together? And
right.
he goes, okay.
Yeah. He's just like, you know, what am I going to do? Start over? No, I guess. Yeah.
Because he shows a lot of range in this movie. As an audience member, you feel very bad for him for the longest time.
Right.
And then he fucking loses it.
He does.
And Barry Lyndon.
Exactly.
That kid.
Bullingdon style. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And like, I mean, is yanking him through the house and spanking him and like assaults him.
Yeah.
And it turns into a monster. But you're also like, yeah, but fuck, man, what are you supposed to do?
He held it in for so long.
Yes.
And then the kid was going out of his way to be a little shit to him by kicking the back of his chair. So
he
knew what he was doing.
This 10-year-old boy was a threat to his marriage.
And it's interesting that, you do see that evolution of his character where at first he's just laughing about it. He's dismissive. He thinks
it's kind of cute. Everyone
thinks
it's kind of cute at
first. He finds it kind of cute and kind of endearing. He's like, oh, this little kid, I don't know what his angle is, but this is pretty funny. This is going to be a good story later on. And then, slowly but surely, he starts to have those moments where he's like, this kid could really be a threat to this marriage, to this relationship.
Yeah, although I will say in that that very first elevator scene where he goes and gets the boy and they're in the elevator by themselves.
Yeah.
First of all, the movie does so much with the face acting.
Yes.
And in his face in that scene, and we'll talk about the scene.
Right.
And the shot of all shots later. But even in the elevator early on, he goes from like amusement to I saw a glimmer of like, this is going to be a problem for me.
Yeah.
Like this kid is a threat to me.
Because I think the kid has such a seriousness and he's so grounded and he's not
great.
He's not needy at all. He's not looking for anybody's approval.
No.
Even when he's kind of confronted with, you know, evidence that maybe he's not who he says he is, you know, his response is always something along the lines of like, I don't care and it doesn't matter and it's not going to change a thing about, you know, how I feel.
Well, when they ask him to not see her anymore, he goes, I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
And they ask him like five times and every time he goes, no, I can't.
He does not budge.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously Nicole Kidman's character finds that very moving, very endearing.
Yeah.
She's like, there really is something there. Like, this kid is not bending at all on this. And he seems, maybe he's mistaken, but he really does seem to believe this. And that's, I think, initially what really compels her about the kid.
Yeah, I can see how an audience would hate this, I think.
Yeah.
But I just didn't.
Just taking it, again, at face value, it's like this is such an absurd story. But, I mean, again, I think that's what makes it so moving in a lot of ways is that, you know, I think relationships, love itself is very irrational.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, that's what is kind of beautiful about it is that it doesn't add up and it doesn't necessarily make sense.
Right.
And if you were to look at a situation from the outside with that kind of purely rational perspective, you could say, why is that person with that person? It makes no sense, you know?
Yeah.
They should be with this other person. They're a way better fit.
Yeah,
you know, their families are similar, whatever the thing may be. But, it is this kind of like unknown factor that we cannot necessarily account for.
Yeah.
That is like the thing that draws us to somebody else so powerfully.
Yeah, there's so much that Glazer withholds from the audience that is a real, I think as a filmmaker, that's sort of the hardest thing to resist.
Yeah.
Is to give too much.
Sure.
And explain too much. And he withholds so much, not only in terms of just like, who are these people? Like, it really, you don't know till an hour plus in who Anne Heche even is.
Yeah,
There's that whole beginning, or Stormare.
Exactly.
Where I was like, well, who are these people then? Why is she having, why does she want to go to this party?
Right.
Why is she bearing this gift?
Yeah.
But also withholding emotionally, like, it would have been a real knee-jerk reaction as a director, I think, to make Nicole Kidman's character this sort of hippy-dippy, like, well, of course she believes in reincarnation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, she was the opposite of her scientist husband.
Right.
So she's buying right into this.
Yeah.
It really, you don't know where she stands because I don't think she knows where she stands.
Yeah, she's openly conflicted about it.
Yeah. So much of a richer thing, though.
Yeah.
Than I think what most films might have thought considered doing.
I mean, it reminds me of, this is kind of pretentious, but Kierkegaard, the philosopher, who his whole attitude towards like Christianity was that the whole story is kind of absurd on its face, the resurrection and so on. But he's like, I believe because it is absurd. Like, that's why there's faith rather than just, you know, looking at the facts and the evidence and being like, okay, I'm on board. Like, the whole point is that it is difficult to believe and it's hard to accept with your rational mind. And yet that is why it's such a powerful thing for people who possess that kind of belief. So, I think it's important that she, on the one hand, can very easily talk about how this is like an impossibility, and yet here it is. You know, it's that contradiction, that paradox.
Because of love, love is
kind of overcomes
heart over brain.
All rationality. Yeah,
It definitely. I mean, Nicole Kidman was in Eyes Wide Shut. Arliss Howard was Rafter Man.
Yep.
So there were a couple of, for some reason, I was thinking Danny Houston might have been in a Kubrick film, but I don't
know. He has that look, but I don't think so. But he definitely has Kubrick-y. That kind of energy somehow, yeah.
And right off the bat, I mean, we can talk a little bit about just some of the filmmaking aspects and the framing and how it relates to Kubrick.
Yeah.
And that opening shot right out of the gate of,
beautiful.
Of Sean, sort of a faceless Sean.
Yeah, you only see him from the back. You never see his face, which I think
dark,
is also an interesting choice.
Dark hoodie.
Yeah.
Running with that perfectly center frame, running through the snow.
Yeah, Central Park.
Maybe a little bit of a Shining shout as well.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
And that score, you know, there's Wagner just all throughout this thing.
Although I think that opening scene is original score. It's Alexandre Desplat.
Right. He wrote the score, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's another aspect to talk about this film, like the number of collaborators that he has mm-hmm. that are all like worth,
masters.
You know, yeah, masters of their own field, especially Desplat, Harris Savitas, uh-huh. cinematographer, and then, you know, the cast that he assembled, the screenwriter, et cetera.
He cast Lauren Bacall.
I know.
How great
is
that?
I know. And she's great. She's,
yeah,
again,
she's really good.
She has that kind of...
It wasn't like a cameo or
a
throwaway
thing. And
she has that gravitas.
Yeah, she just brings like such weight to the role of the kind of matriarch, you know, the one who's kind of running the whole family.
Yeah, and if you can cast Lauren Bacall, why not?
By all means.
Or if you can get these... I mean, when you're hearing the score... Like, I love me a good movie soundtrack, but when you hear a score like this in a film like this, I was thinking last night, in fact, I even typed, why would you do anything else ever?
Yeah.
If you can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, get a true symphonic, like, masterpiece.
I know.
It's, like, why would you do anything else?
And it adds such an energy to the film, I think. And there's so many moments where visually he's just kind of sitting on a close-up or he's doing one of his slow kind of push-ins, dolly-ins, dolly-back.
Uh-huh.
But the energy from that kind of pulsing score just really propels the emotion and keeps it moving, even when visually it can be a little static.
Yeah.
That just kind of, I think it gives the movie just the right amount of lift and kind of movement that it needs.
Uh-huh.
And it gives the sense that, you know, that there's a lot more happening beneath the surface because there's all this kind of bass that is like pulsing.
Yeah.
And it just gives like the idea of like, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, but there's so much more buried underneath.
Yeah, but the score as well doesn't. It could have gone a little more dire sounding.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and sort of tipped toward horror.
Yeah,
very easily, but it didn't. The whole time,
only at the end, I think, on the beach, does he kind of allow it to become this kind of like tragic thing.
What a shot.
But the rest of the time, it's not really commenting on the action so much as it is just like this propulsive kind of engine that keeps us kind of locked into what's happening.
Well, let's talk about the shot.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
They figure out who Sean's dad is.
Yeah.
They go to see him in the building. He's in the building tutoring someone. They have this great hallway scene where, you know, they say you can't be doing this, and they leave. They're leaving to go out for the night to, I guess, the opera, even though you don't see the stage.
Right.
And you see him collapse in the hallway.
Yeah, after he's said, no, I will not guarantee that I'm not going to see her again. I will not leave her alone.
Collapses,
I love her.
Like he collapsed when he died.
Yeah,
in
true.
In the jogging tunnel.
Yeah.
And Nicole Kidman sees this just sort of as she's leaving.
Yeah.
And then the next shot you see is this just, is them entering the opera house. And it follows them down the aisles until they get to their row, across the row. And the camera's just going in and in and in. And it meets them in their seats on her face and holds there for...
Like 3 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like an hour.
Yeah, it really does. And it's a remarkable shot because...
It's remarkable.
You're not seeing... You're hearing the music, the Wagner music.
Yep.
That's obviously intense and beautiful and emotional. And... Yeah, all you see is Nicole Kidman's face, and you watch just over the course of 3 minutes, you kind of watch her have all these questions in her mind.
All the emotions,
yeah, happening kind of simultaneously, and just like the subtle way that her, like she moves the corners of her mouth.
Yes.
Or, you know, her eyes widen or close.
Yeah,
or
man.
There's even like, it's so subtle, you don't even see like a tear roll down her face, which she does in a few other scenes.
But her eyes are wet.
Yeah, her eyes are wet, and you can see that. And when she kind of moves her eyes in one direction, you can see in the corner there is a tear that just hasn't started to fall yet.
And the red.
Yeah, like, the redness.
As she had been crying, perhaps.
Yeah.
And there's that one part where she's so locked in on her own self, and Danny Houston leans in, and it startles her.
And she jumps. Yeah.
It's so fucking good,
man. And it's like, it's a big jump, but it's also a small jump. You register it because you're so locked
so
in on
real.
Everything she's doing. And yeah, you do feel, again, you feel that conflict that she's having this like private, internal, kind of like emotional whirlwind that's happening.
Yeah.
And she's so locked in on that when he whispers to her, it just makes her jump, and it also kind of takes her out of that moment.
Uh-huh.
And
But then she's right back in it.
Yeah, but you can see that, again, it's that conflict that she has this new relationship, but the old one still has such a pull on her that even something as absurd as this 10-year-old boy saying that he is, you know, her lost, you know, husband, is enough to kind of draw her in and think like the wishful thinking is so powerful that she wants to see it. She wants to believe it, even though it is absurd.
Yeah, I mean, this is not hyperbolic. That is one of the most astounding shots and bits of acting I've ever seen.
Well, it's like the old saying, and I forget who said it first, but, you know, the greatest special effect in cinema is a close-up of the human face, right?
Yeah.
It's like gets back to, like,
Dreyer's— Mel Brooks.
Yeah, like Joan of Arc or whatever. Like, the just there's nothing more compelling to look at than a human face that is emoting, that is feeling something, that's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that caliber of an actor that can portray thought and just, you know—
Wordless.
Wordless, and you can sit on it for minutes and minutes, and it's compelling.
And he sat on it for an absurd length of time, like on purpose. Like,
it
required that, I think, for that weight to really—
For the effect to work, for you to see her go through that entire— And it's interesting, too, because if you think about the alternates, you know, a lesser film, maybe, you know, she paces in a room or something, and she vocalizes these things to herself. You know, have those kind of bad scenes of characters thinking out loud.
Oh,
it can't be true, but what if it is?
Right.
You know, all that stuff.
You don't
like
need anything.
You don't need it. You wouldn't accept it as a viewer nearly as easily as you accept something that is unspoken and more purely like emotional and visual. It just allows us to kind of take that leap with her. And sort of believe the impossible.
Yeah, I bet there are some acting teachers who cue that up.
Oh yeah,
on the day that they work on wordless acting or face acting.
Yes,
it's like what else would you use? I mean, there are plenty of great examples, but boy, Nicole Kidman.
Yeah,
I mean she's so underrated still. I think.
Yeah, this is just a masterclass. The whole performances.
Man, so great. So I'm still on the edge of my seat at this point because I still have no idea how it's going to resolve. And that's sort of the thing that's hanging out there, like the gun that you see in Act One that you know is going to go
Chekhov's
off.
Gun. Yeah.
But the gun is this kid.
Yeah.
And it's just so tense because it didn't feel like supernatural.
Right.
And it didn't feel like there would be magic at the end where he does a Josh Baskin.
Right.
So it's such an unsettling feeling. I think that's why people might tip it toward like thriller or horror. Because there's an unsettling feeling because you have no idea the resolution to come.
Yeah, you're not sure what the boundaries are, what the rules are, how far this might go, or what route it might take.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you are, for one moment to the next, constantly being surprised by the film. And it's going in these directions you don't expect it to. And it is like a perfect case of one of those movies that is probably best to see, with as little information as possible.
That was the very first thing I typed in and I knew the premise, unfortunately, was that she thinks it's her dead husband.
Right,
but if you knew nothing, then that's the best way.
Yeah, it really is to just be
so
taken
if you're listening
on this,
to this and you haven't seen it,
yeah, you kind of screwed up. Like, bail now and watch it. Come back.
I want to talk about the interrogation scene. There's a scene where young Sean, to prove himself, is interrogated by Arliss Howard.
Yep.
I guess she's the brother. Is she another brother or is she brother-in-law? Yeah, brother-in-law.
Yeah, brother-in-law and then
to Nicole
her sister.
Kidman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's you get three perspectives on this because you get the actual interrogation and what's going on with Arliss Howard and young Sean, who I don't think we mentioned the guy's name yet. We need to shout out Cameron Bright.
Oh, he's
who does such a good job.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Then you get another perspective, which is the tape being played of that session in front of Arliss Howard and the whole family.
Yeah.
And then you also, and I think this is easily overlooked, but you have Sean's mom in the room next door in the kitchen listening in on this.
Yeah.
And she's like, let's talk about her character for a minute. Let me see. What is her name? Kara Seymour.
Yeah. She's great too.
From Adaptation.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
She's
awesome. I feel like I haven't seen her anything in a while, but
she's underrated
as well. She's so great in Adaptation as well.
But let's talk about her character because this is a situation where we don't hang with Buffalo Bill, Ted Levine too much. You mainly see what's going on through her eyes.
Yes.
But this is a situation where her 10-year-old son is, from her perspective, acting crazy.
Yeah.
And this family is sort of not buying it, but like Nicole Kidman's lobbying to have him spend the night and exactly. I'll pick him up from school.
Yeah, I think that's another there's a power class thing where Nicole Kidman feels almost entitled in a way to just be like, I'm going to keep him for a night and just, you know.
Like, that's okay, right?
That's fine. That's,
and
I'm
what
sure
is she
going to
say? No?
Yeah, yeah.
She's not.
And then it seems like she even keeps him a second night without even really calling to check in or, you know, she has this line like, that doesn't, I hope you weren't too worried. Like, that doesn't bother you, does it?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the poor mother's on like the couch smoking cigarettes and like clearly been stressing the whole day.
The shots, it's just so, like, as a parent, it's so distressing.
Yeah.
Like, I found myself empathizing with her character.
Oh, yeah.
Like, to a more degree than anyone else in the film, I think.
Yeah.
And she's not even in that much of it.
And you kind of feel like her character maybe felt like she couldn't say no, which is a strange thing to think about. Your child that
I know.
There's this other random person that is more entitled to, you know, have your kid around.
Right. Because if it were switched, Nicole Kidman would be like,
it would be absurd.
No way. Like,
that's not happening. Yeah.
Like, they'd hire a security guard to make sure that lady wouldn't come near their building.
This person, you know, get them out of my sight, you know?
Yeah. But I don't think it's also played as like, she thinks if she goes along with this, there may be a pot of gold for her.
No.
Which, maybe
like you
with
said,
that one
could have been,
line
could have been a dimension there, but I think it's more like, I think, I don't know. It is hard to say exactly what the parents are angling at, especially the dad with that comment about.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it just felt like he deals with a lot of probably wealthy clients.
Yeah,
that he's tutoring their kids to play piano, and I think he just has a certain awareness of that dynamic that, hey, these people have money, you know.
Well, the scene that wrecked me was. When Kara Seymour goes in to tuck him in.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, I'm not your son anymore.
I'm not your stupid little boy anymore. Stupid little boy or whatever, yeah.
Oh, my God. And he turns over and it's just like, I couldn't
even. It's devastating.
Yeah, it's just devastating.
Yeah.
But it's not played overly dramatic. He doesn't, you know, spoon feed like this big moment.
Yeah.
It just sort of happens and you see this woman just her heart breaks right in front of your
exactly.
eyes.
Exactly. She turns off the light and then it just cuts to the next scene and it moves on. But
yeah.
You can again, I think that's something that outside of this particular situation, I think that's something that a lot of parents probably have to face when their kid gets to be like a rebellious teenager. And,
well, there are different versions of this.
Yeah.
Of your child basically shutting the door to their bedroom on you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's every parent's worst fear.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's somewhat inevitable, maybe, you know, at least for a certain kind of kid that is going to go through that rebellious phase.
It can be. I take heart when I see my brother who had these two kids who just like always thought he was the best and are best buddies for life. And I'm trying to cultivate that, man.
Yeah.
Trying to cultivate it.
But it's like, you know, they wanted to find themselves as separate from the parent. And sometimes that it's like a forceful thing.
Right.
And hopefully they come back around, you know.
Yeah. But where we started with this conversation, though, was the interrogation scene.
The kind of the three-way.
Yeah, seeing the three perspectives. Yeah. It was really interesting how that played out.
Yeah, it's so compelling. I mean, it's something that you could think about a film like The Exorcist. You could think about, like, the Gene Hackman, The Conversation. You know, it's always compelling, I think, to watch.
Someone listening to a
tape. Listening to tape and playback and rewinding it and, like, what's the detail that we missed or whatever.
Yeah.
That's such a good, like, thing. Anytime I'm in a film and that's going on, I'm like, oh, this is the best. I love this, you know? the way that the scene, it's so interesting the way it will cut from, for instance, when the boy Sean says to the adult, you know, oh, I thought your wife couldn't have kids or something like that. And then it cuts away at that
Arliss
point.
Arliss Howard in that scene was so great.
Yeah, it cuts away from Arliss Howard and then a few minutes later, it kind of resumes in that same spot, but now we're in the sort of session with the family.
Yeah, the editing in that scene is so great.
And he says, you know, let's just stick to, the main topic here.
Right.
So you know that it's a continuation, but at the same time, there's been this lapse in time. And then it actually ends up jumping back to the original scene, as well as hopping over to the other room where the mother's listening in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a very interesting, when you consider, you know, the amount of coverage he would have had to play that scene out and just the way it is structured and the way it jumps back and forth in time.
Yeah, because you could edit that a number of ways.
Yeah, you could like play it straightforward. You know, you could just kind of do like a progression where it starts on the two of them in the room, then it jumps to the mother, and then it jumps forward to the family listening or something. But the way it bounces back, you know, all three, you kind of realize that he's playing with time as well.
Yeah.
And he's doing something just very interesting with the effect of seeing something happen firsthand versus mm-hmm. listening to it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on who's listening to it, mm-hmm. the dynamics within that room, people looking at each other, not even saying anything.
I was about to say there's not much dialogue there. Yeah. They're not saying like, the fucking kid's crazy.
Yeah, exactly,
or like,
exactly.
Oh my God, how did he know that?
Yeah. Nobody has an obvious bad line like that where they're just like, that's absurd. How could he know that?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you can tell there was just such great care and consideration with the script. Doesn't surprise me that there were, you know, 2 dozen versions or whatever.
And I think it's
great. A hard one to get right.
Yeah, I mean, the casting of, like, the entire extended family, mm-hmm. everybody is so good in their role of just being this believable adult that...
Allison Elliott.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love it. Like, it's great seeing Arliss Howard in this, too, because I feel like I don't see him in...
I know, man.
...a ton either, and he's so good in this.
Yeah,
I mean,
he really is.
He's super, super compelling. There's obviously the Cooper connection, but I mean, just on its own merit, you know, it's fascinating.
I mean, he casts Peter Stormare as kind of a nice guy.
Yeah. Like, I love him kind of playing against type. Yeah.
Yeah. So about halfway through the film, we finally get our first scene, aside from the little very first introductory scene with Sean, but our first scene with Nicole Kidman or with Anna and Sean alone.
Right.
Where they essentially go on a date.
Yeah.
They go get ice cream. They go on a carriage ride.
Yeah.
And this is when you get to see, like, there aren't many moments where he feels like a kid.
Right.
But when he's eating the ice cream, he sort of is.
He's kind of boyish, yeah.
And that scene just, like, I bet they workshopped a lot, like, exactly how to play all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's...
Because it could easily go wrong.
Exactly. I was just thinking about, like, the kind of guts to mm-hmm. go forward with a scene like that where you have lines like... You know, she says
talking about making love.
Yeah, she says to him, you know, a husband needs to like provide for his wife.
Yeah,
you know,
defend his wife.
You gonna get a job? Like, what are you gonna do? And he's like, I'll get a job. And she's like, how are you gonna like take care of my needs? Like, have you ever made love to a girl?
Well, before she says that though, take care of my needs. He goes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. He's like, I know what you're talking about.
She flat out says it.
Yeah.
Like, have you ever made love to a girl?
And it's so great that his reaction is not to say, not to be like. Yeah, one time, or
right,
you know,
right.
like try to play it up.
Or I've seen movies.
Yeah, it's like I know what I'm doing. He just says you would be the first.
Yeah,
you know, and which is so it's like the perfect response to give because
it's weirdly sweet.
He owns up to the fact that he is what he is, which is a 10-year-old boy who obviously doesn't have any experience in that domain.
Uh-huh.
But it's not a weakness,
right?
It's just what it is. It's like you would be the first, and he throws it back to her almost as if like. It would be that much more special or something.
Yeah, it's all
very
matter of fact
with him. I'm this like inexperienced virgin that doesn't know what he's doing or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, again, the restraint, like less is more in this movie for sure.
And his confidence, his just like he says what he means what he says, you know.
Yeah, but it's not like the usually
it's
kid
not
actors
a cocky
you
kind
get
of
this
like,
bravado
yeah,
from
yeah,
a kid
yeah.
like, oh, don't you worry about that.
Yeah,
like,
and it would be like a laugh line.
Yeah,
but, yeah,
none of that.
Yeah.
Like this is the only way to have played this movie.
Yeah.
And it was still very divisive.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because she alternately is sort of a mother to him.
Sure.
But also a potential lover.
Yeah.
And I mean, let's talk about the tub. Well, first of all, before we get to the tub scene.
You have the scene where she's watching him in the park, and
yes.
he's playing on the
and he's
the,
playing
the,
on the
play
jungle
set,
gym.
The jungle gym, yeah.
And you get that great Kubrickian push-in on Danny Houston in the window.
Oh, yeah,
who,
yeah.
I guess is seeing this?
Well, it seems...
Or
no,
is he just
I
in
think,
thought?
I think what it is that they were supposed to look at an apartment that
oh,
day.
Oh, okay, and she blew it off.
And she blew it off to hang out with his kid because she was just going to pick him up at school and take him home.
Right.
But instead, she picked
they
him up and they went on the date. Yeah, they got on the horse-drawn carriage and they hung out in the park and whatever. They ate the ice cream. And so he's having that moment during that Kubrickian push-in where he's just like... Damn, this has gone from a silly thing for us to laugh about to a legitimate threat to
that's almost his
marriage.
Jack Torrance switch being
exactly.
flicked.
It is the Jack Torrance like frozen, you know,
yep.
grizzled looking out the window, that kind of 1,000-yard stare thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Such a great shot. So then we have the tub scene. I mean, this scene is was caused a lot of controversy at the time, and
I think
left
it would
a
cause
lot
even more today.
Oh,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But left a lot of people upset. It's a scene where Nicole Kidman is in the bathtub and Sean comes in and fully undresses. You don't see pee-pee, But you see him
kind of like waist up a little bit.
Yeah, but you see him take everything.
Yeah,
you see him
it's clear that he's
off.
Taking everything off, and then it kind of goes to like a tighter shot when he takes the underwear off. But
yeah.
It is definitely implied that he's fully nude, and
he gets in the tub
gets
with
in
her.
The tub,
but
yeah.
Again, the way they play this is just so like he's got the tightest little hair as a director that
yeah.
you can walk and pull
I
off
know.
The scene because he doesn't. You know, Sean gets in the tub and he doesn't act overtly sexual.
Right.
She doesn't really move. She also doesn't tell him to get out right away.
Yeah, yeah.
They just sort of sit there.
They're kind of testing each other.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they're staring at each other very intensely. And she says to him, what are you doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm looking at my wife.
Yes.
And
I'm looking at my wife.
And just the... Yeah, it's like a standoff. And, like, neither one is going to make a move or do anything.
Uh-huh. But the reaction should be to scream
when
he walks in the room.
Right,
but
right. Like, get out of here.
Stuff.
What are you doing, you know?
Yeah,
and
she's
so,
allowing this behavior to a certain degree. Like, I feel like, though, if he had made a physical move toward her at that moment, she wouldn't.
Right.
Because they'd already had the kiss at this point, right?
Yeah,
I think so.
When did that happen?
Out on the sidewalk.
Yes.
They have a kiss.
Right,
that,
after Danny Houston kind of attacks
right,
him.
That Rafter Man witnesses.
Yes.
And I love that he sees his kiss and he's just sort of like, oh, I'm going back inside.
yeah.
Like, I'm fucking getting
out
of here.
Yeah, he's like, I can't deal with this. Like,
but yeah, that tub scene, man, I didn't get upset by it.
No.
I wasn't offended by it. I didn't think it was creepy. I thought it was perfect for the movie.
It's just, yeah, but it is kind of a marvel of like maintaining exactly the right tone. And there's so many pitfalls. It's kind of the thing of like you're on a high wire,
right?
And you just don't look down. You just don't consider all the myriad ways that it could just be a complete disaster.
I mean, how many hours of discussion went into this scene?
Well, that's the thing is I feel like a film like this with a storyline like that particular scene, I just don't think it would make it to the screen nowadays.
Yeah.
I think that
you're right.
There would be too many. Like voices kind of being like,
studio would say,
shouldn't we just not do this?
Right. Isn't there some other way that you can get this point across?
And I think it's remarkable that, you know, somebody like of Nicole Kidman's caliber obviously read the script, understood what it was going for, trusted the director enough to be like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah,
you know, I trust you. I think that you're making this movie for the right reasons. And I trust that you're actually going to be able to pull it off. You know, it's amazing.
Well, there's also that's part in the scene where Danny Houston is sort of in the apartment and
listening in.
Yeah, and as an audience member, I was thinking, oh fucking, don't open that door.
Yeah,
like don't open that door.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a weird reaction to have.
Right.
You should be thinking like,
open the door
and stop this. Yeah,
exactly. Put an end to this.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Yeah. It's so interesting too that just as he gets more and more kind of actually threatened by what's going on, his position becomes weaker and weaker. It's like
he shows his hand,
and when he shows that to him it's becoming a big deal, suddenly it is a big deal.
Yeah.
And so it's like when she hears the door kind of creak in the floorboard and whatever, and she knows that he's out there listening, and she kind of looks off like, get out of here, leave us alone,
right.
You know, jerk. It's just putting more of a wedge between the two of them, and it's sort of an us versus them dynamic, and she's very much with Sean at that moment.
I know.
Which is just...
She's crossed over.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really interesting to watch how little by little she's kind of like worn down to accept the impossible.
Well, there's too much evidence.
Yeah.
He knows too much.
Way too much that...
She had not kissed him by that point, by the way, because I have it sort of chronologically noted out here. Danny Houston flips out after that. That's when he does the Barry Lyndon spank.
During the wedding kind
of. Yeah, and then Sean runs out and she runs out after him. That's when she kisses him.
Yeah, yeah.
But even the way that's played is very sweet.
Yeah.
And almost motherly.
Right. Well, that's the line. That's like the weird line because like there's a great moment too kind of near the end of their relationship where she comes home. He's already in bed, and he's shirtless, and you kind of assume that maybe he's just wearing underwear or something underneath the covers. And she walks, she kind of goes to his side, and she bends down, and you kind of think, what's she going to do? Is she going to pull the covers down? Like, what's going to happen here? And it's like she has this moment of hesitation, and then she tucks him in.
She tucks him in.
And it's like her tucking him in is like asserting this kind of motherly thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's also just in a literal sense, it's like, I'm tucking you in. You're not getting out of those covers. you know, this is not going to be a situation where, you know, we're going to embrace each other or something. She's like, I'm tucking you in and, you know, I'm just going to be this motherly kind of thing.
Well, but her plan, though, is so heartbreaking at the end. She wants this to be her true love so much.
Yeah.
She basically was like, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We're going to run away.
Yep.
And in 10 years, this will all be okay.
It's weird, too. She says 21. She's like, in 11 years, it'll be 21. I was like, why not shave 3 years off of that? But I guess just to make it a little more respectable or something, you know?
But that's such a heartbreaking scene because it's like, it just shows how much she loved Sean.
Yeah.
That she's willing to give up this new guy who, the middle part where he freaks out aside, is a pretty good dude, it seems like.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of...
They could have played him for an evil guy or something. Or
he could have been a
real
heel.
Shown him at work doing really bad things behind
the
scenes.
Right, right, yeah.
Those are sort of the obvious things I've seen in other films, but it doesn't show that.
No.
Like, he seems like a decent guy.
He's much more sympathetic than, like, Barry Lyndon is, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
When Barry Lyndon loses his cool, you're kind of on Bullingdon's side. You're like, yeah, he is a jerk. And it is cool that you got a rise out of him finally and got him to like embarrass himself in front of all the important people.
Yeah, this is a movie where the empathy is very evenly distributed.
Right. There's no bad guy,
mm-mm,
really. And you feel for people on all sides. Which
everyone's
is just,
right and everyone's wrong.
Yeah, it's like the Renoir thing. Like everybody has their reasons.
Right.
Like everybody's just kind of doing the thing that they would do in this situation.
Yeah.
Even if they end up on opposite sides of things, we as an audience kind of want the best for everybody, even though that's kind of somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's sort of an impossibility that everyone's going to walk away from this thing unhurt. But but we do want that. And I think that's also part of why it's...
What, for everyone to be unhurt?
Yeah, for everyone to be unhurt, for everyone to just be okay. 'Cause,
did you want it to be Sean?
Mm, I don't.
That's kind of the big question, right?
I mean...
It's like, do you want... As an audience member, do you want that to be Sean?
My like interpretation of the movie is that it is in some ways. It's almost like an incomplete version because he doesn't know this Anne Heche thing.
Right.
But it's like he is like the embodiment somehow of this more idealized, almost non-existent love that Nicole Kidman had for her late husband.
Right.
Like he is like the embodiment, the personification of this like perfect projection that she had of who he was, that his love was pure, that he never cheated on her, that...
Did she... Maybe I missed this, but she didn't find out about the affair, did she?
Exactly. She
so
never
she
does.
Still
She's still in the dark. That's why Anne Heche was going to give her all those letters.
Right, which she does
which
not
Which was
do.
Devastating because there's dozens of them, it appears, and they were all unopened.
Right.
By,
and that was his proof to her that he doesn't love Nicole Kidman.
And it was this thing, again, this is where the class dynamic comes in, that the real Sean apparently was carrying on this affair for years.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't leave Nicole Kidman because he felt like he couldn't.
Right.
And the reason he probably felt like he couldn't was because it was sort of like a golden handcuffs situation.
Oh, because she had the money?
She had the money. And he's like, I can't give up this like great thing. I'm set for life. So I've just
And as a scientist, maybe that's why he's a scientist. He's essentially funded.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, he's able to live way above what his means would be if he were just living off his like university earnings. But instead, he's become part of this, like, you know, elite world.
Right.
And so, it also goes to show the kind of that dilemma that happens in Barry Lyndon as well, where it's like almost like an arranged marriage kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where the marriage is more for the acquisition of title and status and, you know, solidifying various assets and so on.
Right.
You see the same thing here where it's like the pure love comes from underneath, comes from the working class, or it comes from just something completely outside your own world.
Uh-huh.
And for all these practical, pragmatic reasons, it doesn't make any sense. And yet there it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more kind of like responsible, reasonable, well, he's a nice guy.
Right.
He's got a really good job. And, you know, we're from kind of the same circles and so on.
Yeah.
This kind of makes sense. You know, that consideration versus I will give up everything and run away with you, even though you're a 10-year-old boy and you say you're my dead husband. Like, that's the thing that's more compelling to her heart, to her, you know, emotionally.
Yeah.
That's the thing that grips her.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe I didn't really pick up on that. I feel like a dum-dum now. The whole point of the letters was to hint that that's where Sean had been getting his information.
Right, right.
And that he dug those up.
But there's this thing that
hold on a second. Not
yeah, because she
that he dug those up.
She so what happens is that she is going to this party. She's right. got them in the package.
Uh-huh.
And then she makes up the story about, oh, I forgot the ribbon.
Right.
Because she's delaying. She's reconsidering it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she walks outside and she does, you know, bury them in the park just mm-hmm. to kind of get rid of them.
And he's following her.
And he follows her and he sees her bury them.
Right.
So the implication is that he then dug them up after she left, opened them all and read mm-hmm. them. And then that is how he got all his information about who everybody is.
So he was just there because he happened to be in the building because his father was tutoring
right,
someone there.
Right.
And he would take him along and make him sit in the lobby.
Yeah, that's the implication.
Oh, okay. And then he just did all of this as
yeah.
a 10-year-old boy.
But the
prank.
the weird thing is that, you know, I think there are moments where, for instance, like the maid, you know, the sort of like uh-huh. live-in maid that they have, he doesn't seem to fully remember her
uh-huh.
At first, you know. Or like, for instance, the woman that tells Nicole Kidman that there is no Santa Claus.
Yeah, yeah.
She asked about that.
He said, I'll know her when I see her or something.
Exactly. He's like, I'll know her when I see her.
Yeah.
And he does.
Yeah.
And there are a few situations like that where
yeah.
it's kind of like you get this feeling that the version of Sean that's kind of been reincarnated in this boy
mm-hmm.
has like a limited scope of knowledge. Like it is Sean, but it's not the full Sean.
Mm-hmm.
It's a certain amount of Sean, and he can kind of like extend those boundaries a little bit by encountering firsthand, like sitting at the desk where Sean worked or something.
So you're going full supernatural.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has.
I mean, that's
that,
one explanation.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know that it's necessarily that. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that's hard to make into a coherent kind of theory.
Has Glazer ever spoken on this?
I don't know. I think Glazer is a little bit, you know, he doesn't seem to do as much like press or as much kind of mm-hmm. speaking about the meaning of things.
He worships Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah,
he?
I mean, I think he definitely subscribes to that school of like the
yeah.
film speaks for itself.
I mean, no one wants to hear that interview though, where
no,
he goes,
of course not.
Oh, well, here's the deal.
Here's A to Z, everything.
Sean is just a kid
exactly,
and
exactly.
he found these letters and yeah. it was just a big prank.
Yeah.
Like no one wants to see that interview.
Yeah. But the movie does, I mean, it certainly does go pretty far in that direction
mm-hmm.
to explain a lot of it. I just feel like there are these edge cases where there's still things that mm-hmm. it's kind of like, I don't think that was in those letters and I don't know how he would have connected quite so many of these dots and known quite so many of these things.
Yeah. But when you think about some of the things that were said, like, I didn't think you could have kids. That could have been in a letter.
That's true.
We made love on the green couch. That could have been in a letter.
You know, how would he have known where he died in the park? You know,
oh.
I mean, maybe it was in the paper, but
obituary.
I mean, but would they really specify like
drops dead
at this exact
street tunnel?
Yeah. 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 I mean,
Central Park West.
That seems kind of far fetched.
Yeah, that's true. Because he has her meter there.
Yeah.
That's where their first like big meeting is.
Right. So I think there's, to me, there's just like, you can account for a lot of it by the letters, but you can't account for all of it.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of, to me, that's the takeaway is that you're supposed to still have these lingering doubts of like, yeah it probably wasn't. Yeah, it was probably this weird thing. But what if, you know,
right.
there's always going to be that lingering doubt, that uncertainty of, maybe it was somehow.
Right, but he's also not like, again, a lesser film would have sold you on the power of true love.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it would have been so much more schmaltzy.
Right, right.
Like this movie could have gone so horribly
off
the rails.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I
mean,
we've seen
this story about like, you know, the dead husband is reincarnated as
yeah.
some other form.
Or
and then,
big. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of things at play here that
yeah.
we've seen before, but I've never seen it done like this.
Never seen it kind of done as a straightforward drama. Asking emotionally, what would this do to somebody?
And it feels how Kubrick
really
might
happened.
Have done it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, when we say it's Kubrickian, it's not just the shots and the tone, but like there's a spirit
right.
that sort of is inhabited here
yeah.
a bit.
Yeah, and I think Kubrick, you know, in a lot of his films too, I mean, like when he talks about The Shining, he's like, I think The Shining is an optimistic film because
yeah.
any ghost story implies that there is something greater beyond. I think this is similar in that
uh-huh.
way that, you know, it is a ghost story in
yeah.
a certain sense or a reincarnation story or just something that there has to exist something larger than, you know,
mm-hmm.
the scientific world, what we today know to be observable and measurable.
Yeah.
And in some way that's an optimistic thing because it means that it's not all just, you know,
yeah.
what we see in front of us.
We're not worm dirt.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything's possible. couple of other favorite parts here, as we're kind of wrapping this up, is the very first scene where Sean enters the apartment during the birthday party.
Yes.
They turn off all the lights, and that allows him to slip in. And he just sort of walks into the room where they are, and yeah. he's in there with them, and they don't know it.
Yeah.
And then the lights come on. That had a sort of a horror feeling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That this boy is just now standing in there, but well, because yeah. it's a boy, he's not a threat.
Yeah.
So no one's like, "What the fuck? Who are you?"
Everyone's just
what are
kind
you doing
of like,
in my
"Well, this is weird."
Yeah.
They're
and it's
kind
a
of
New York apartment,
by it,
so
but, yeah.
like, sure, some kid might wander.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah.
But the framing in that scene. Is very much reminding me of Kubrick because it looked mm-hmm. like a painting.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember
the
all of
them. The tableau of all the family members.
Yeah,
and,
around
yeah,
the table.
Absolutely.
And there were a few shots like that that looked like paintings.
I mean, I think the, you know, like having it lit practically by those candles.
Yeah, for
obviously
sure.
a very Barry Lyndon kind of thing
yeah.
for Kubrick to do as well
it's
as
a beautiful movie.
All the kind of practicals you see in shots that just get blown out to pure white.
Yeah.
That's very Kubrickian. The apartment itself, I think, you could compare to like Rosemary's Baby because she also yeah. has that haircut
uh-huh.
That's very and, similar yep. to that film.
I saw some reviews where they say it definitely echoed Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of some of the other – we can kind of hit the highlights of the Kubrickian similarities here. I mean, obviously,
any
the,
of
slow,
those push
the slow
ends.
Zooms.
Yeah, they did that
the kind
one
of thousand-yard
where,
stare, which the kid does at one point and also Danny Houston does.
Yeah, when he does the double push.
Yeah.
Because the Danny Houston one, I forgot, pushing in on the window is edited together with pushing in on Nicole on
right.
the park bench as
right.
she's watching Sean play.
Right. Yeah.
So, that's one of the great shots in movies, that
yes.
slow push.
You have that. You have a couple little nods, like one of the kind of the bellhops on the first floor
yeah.
is throwing a ball against the wall.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Jack and the Shining.
Uh-huh, Jimmy.
let's see. What else do you have?
Well, and just the score itself.
Yes,
is,
yeah.
You know, Stanley Kubrick very famously
classical.
Rarely used any, I guess, Full Metal Jacket was the only movie where he used pop music.
Yeah.
But yeah, that symphonic classical score is just so Kubrickian.
Yeah. And we should talk a little bit about the cinematographer, Harris Savitas.
Yeah, so what's his deal?
He is my pick for, like, the best cinematographer of the last half of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah?
And unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. He died pretty young, I think around 51.
Over Roger Deakins, huh?
Yeah, yeah. No, for me, there's no none higher than
Harris Savitas.
So what
was he shot?
So Harris Savitas, he starts off in music videos and commercials.
Okay.
He works a lot with like Ridley Scott early on.
Okay.
He works quite a bit with Mark Romanek in music videos. So he shoots a lot of iconic stuff like the Closer video for Nine Inch Nails.
Okay.
He shoots. Let me pull up. I made a whole
no,
list.
No, I've looked at it here now. He shot Zodiac.
Yeah,
he shot The Bling Ring.
One of his first features anyway is The Game for Fincher. He
yeah.
goes on to shoot Zodiac as well.
Finding Forrester.
Yeah. He worked. He had probably his best. Definitely, I think his best collaboration was over several films with Gus Van Sant.
Oh yeah.
Including
he shot Elephant.
Yeah, Elephant, which is probably my pick for one of the best looking movies
yeah.
ever. But also Jerry for Gus Van Sant.
Didn't see that.
Jerry's incredible
yeah,
as well.
I need to see that's the Matt Damon one, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Casey Affleck.
Shot some Sofia Coppola somewhere
yeah,
in
yeah,
Bling Ring.
Yeah, exactly. And Bling Ring, he started, but he didn't finish because that was around the time that he started getting really sick. So
what
another
what killed him?
His assistant. Well, I think what killed him was some kind of terminal condition.
Mm.
I forget now exactly what it was. But he started on Bling Ring, and then his assistant, another great cinematographer in his own right, Christopher Blovell, had to finish that film.
Wow.
And Blovell, interesting, is sort of almost like the heir to Harris Savitas because he shoots quite a bit with Sofia Coppola,
yeah.
with Kelly Reichardt. He also shot with Gus Van Sant a recent film he made with Joaquin Phoenix called Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot.
Which, I've heard of that.
I love that film, actually.
Yeah, I didn't
it
see
got
it.
Kind of mixed reception, but to me, it's like the best thing Gus Van Sant's done in quite a while.
Oh, wow.
And Gus Van Sant was like a really, really important filmmaker for me in kind of his 2000s period
mm-hmm.
when he made that trilogy of Jerry, Elephant, Last Days,
mm-hmm.
His kind of death trilogy, which, again, all were shot with Harris Savitas. He was being influenced a lot by this Hungarian filmmaker, Bellatar,
mm-hmm.
who works quite a lot in extremely long takes, a lot of following shots. If you have characters walking from one location to another, he'll just shoot them walking, and you see their heads kind of bobbing up and down for minutes on end. So Harris Savitas, to me, is like, I think he was such an elite kind of cinematographer, and he had this, you know, income through, again, commercials and music videos. He could pick his projects,
right?
Like, you know, as a cinematographer.
His list of films is great.
I mean, yeah, there's hardly any duds in there, and he's one of the rare filmmakers that, or cinematographers, that I would actually watch something of his because he shot it. Because I think even the best cinematographers typically, like a Roger Deakins or something, it's more for me like if he shoots something for the Coen brothers, like obviously I'm going to see that anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's films that they work on that I just kind of go, whatever, you know. but, like, everything Harris Savitas did, it was almost like a seal of approval. It's like, well, if Harris wants to make this movie, there's got to be something more to it that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
He worked a bit with James Gray as well, and James Gray is another one of my favorite filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, he worked with most of the filmmakers he worked with more than once.
Yeah.
Which is always a good sign.
Yes.
Noah Baumbach with Greenberg and Margot at the Wedding.
And Greenberg's a beautiful film, too. Yeah. It has like a real 70s kind of quality to it that, I mean, that was the Savitas aesthetic, was shooting on lenses from bygone eras that didn't have the coatings on the lens so that you get more reflections, you get more flares. The whole thing is like lower contrast.
Mm-hmm.
He was a huge proponent of shooting very low contrast negative and then kind of adding contrast as needed in post. But that way he could control exactly how much contrast there was. And he was a big believer in the idea that, you know, in real life, when we're looking at something, very rarely is there like true black, you know, like 000 kind of thing. There's always shades of something in there. There's always colors kind of filtering in. And so he was very interested in what he called the toe or the toenail of the negative, which is like the very, very bottom before it goes to pure black. He thought that was where all the kind of magic and interesting stuff happened in. And so he was known for, in cinematography terms, exposing to like hold the highlights so nothing's burnt out, and then just letting the rest of it fall where it would.
Right.
And, you know, he talks a lot about like when he would be in some of these low light scenes, because he's very fond of underexposure, sometimes like a stop and a half, two stops. He's very fond of just letting, lighting a room, lighting a space, and then letting the actors live within that space, but not putting a spotlight on an actor, saying like, here's your key light, here's your mark, do this, do that. Like letting people fall into shadow. So you get so much more of the emotion out of a scene if an actor is, you know, kind of in and out of the light. It just feels more real and less kind of presentational. And so he would go to extremes like baking film in ovens, flashing film, you know, shooting on one stock and printing on another that you would not normally pair together.
Yeah.
Just all this kind of stuff. And sometimes it would even get him into trouble where there's a scene in The Yards where it's this long, complicated scene where it's like 15, 20 characters all together in this house.
Right.
And everybody's talking at different, you know, there's a million kind of pieces of coverage you would need to get to make that happen. And he underexposed the whole thing so much that there was nothing on the negative when they finished after like 2 weeks or something.
Oh, man.
And he and James Gray had to go to the studio and be like, oh, actually, we need to reshoot this, you know?
Geez.
And the funny thing about it is, of course, he is a world-class cinematographer, so he could easily just expose properly, get the image in the can every time, and probably to the average viewer, it would be fine. You know, it'd be like, it looks like a movie. But he was not interested in that. He wanted that. He wanted to exist in that zone of uncertainty and like butterflies when you're at dailies the next day and kind of being like, I don't know if that's going to come out or not, you know, and just breaking all the rules. So he, I would encourage anybody to, you know, just go through his whole filmography and
these are all good movies.
It's a lot of remarkable stuff in there.
He died of brain cancer at 55, leaving behind a wife and daughter. Wow.
So sad. I mean, he, like I said, he, I can't think of anybody from the last several decades. Like, to me, he's kind of the heir to, like, a Gordon Willis or something. Somebody who also preferred dark images and created something that was, like, you know, almost more painterly than, like, photographic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Here's an admission that's going to displease you. I've not seen any of those three Gus Van Sant films.
Oh, and
I love
they're
Gus
beautiful.
Van Sant.
Yeah.
Somehow I did not see Jerry Elephant or Last Days.
And they're all fairly polarizing films too.
Yeah.
This
I'm
is
all
when
about it.
When Gus Van Sant was interested in a lot of long takes, minimal dialogue, sometimes only improvised dialogue. I think a lot of the dialogue in Elephant is more or less improvised by these non-actors, kids that he's working with. And
yeah.
Jerry, there's a really funny script of Jerry where it's the entire screenplay sits on like one or two sheets of paper.
Really?
And it's just,
no dialogue,
and literally like a scene will just be walking, walking, yeah. walking, talking, walking, getting worried, feeling lost, panicking, sleeping, waking up, walking. And, you know, they made the whole film based on that.
So the other thing that I wanted to say, the other part that I really loved, very small part, at the end of the film, after sort of everything sort of resolved more or less,
yeah.
and Lauren Bacall is sitting there with a kid, and she just goes, "I never liked Sean."
Yeah, yeah.
In the past tense, which says,
"I love that." Yeah.
First of all, it's a revelation that she
right.
didn't like him.
Yeah.
This her daughter's husband,
right.
who she loved.
Yeah.
And then this past tense where it's like, "You're not him.
You're not him, and I didn't like him anyway. If
right.
you were, yeah."
And it's Bacall, so it's just like,
and I, it's
so
great too
great.
Because you know, as we have learned more about the Sean, the real Sean,
yeah,
she was right maybe to not like him because right. he was basically
he was
using
cheating.
His wife, you know, and kind of carrying on an affair with somebody else.
Yeah,
so it's like Lauren Bacall had that killer instinct.
Yeah,
maybe she didn't know precisely what he was doing, but she knew enough. Like, I don't trust him. I don't like him.
Yeah.
But you also get the sense that she has probably never said that to her daughter.
Right.
You know?
But it makes sense. Like, if she was not enamored of Sean, she would not be enamored of the new Sean.
She's not susceptible the same way Nicole Kidman is to,
that's
like,
right.
this wish fulfillment thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about that final image. You know, they get married.
Yeah.
And does she read the letter there? I couldn't quite get that. Or is she just reflecting upon the letter?
I think she's reflecting upon it. Yeah.
And just... Oh, God, what a great way to end this movie. That heartbreaking shot of her walking into the ocean.
And there's a scene right
like
before it where
wailing.
She's getting her photo made by herself in her dress by the photographer. It lingers for a really long time on the photographer, like, metering her and saying, step this way, do this.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to a reverse where you see Danny Houston kind of walking into her eye line.
Yeah.
As if, and he has this kind of, like, Cheshire Cat grin of, like, it's official. We've done it. You know, now we're really married. Like, you can't run away now sort of thing almost. It's this sort of self-satisfied thing. And,
but she does.
Yeah. And she kind of, it brings it all back. And she kind of has this like moment of like, what have I done? You know, I don't necessarily love this man. My love for him anyway is not pure the way it was for Sean.
Yeah.
It's a compromise. And now the rest of my life is going to be about this compromise. It's not going to be this like youthful, exuberant, like love that, you know, conquers all.
Yeah.
It's this kind of adult, responsible, safe thing to do.
Yeah.
And it just,
she just breaks down.
It's devastating watching her on that beach and,
but
you know,
she goes with him though. Like she allows him to console her.
He, you know, he's very, very gentle with her, the way he kind of approaches her very tentatively. And she kind of steps to the side and he steps a little bit with her, like as if she's going to run away. And then he just kind of slowly embraces her. And
but you feel bad for him again in that moment.
You feel bad for both people.
On his wedding
like,
day, he sees her break down
in
like desperate tears.
And he kind of, I think he understands in that moment, like this is something that's going to be a factor that we're both going to be dealing with for the rest of our lives probably because she's always going to have this first love that she is, you know, is kind of unresolved and unfinished in some way.
Man. So good.
Yeah.
All right, dude. I think we did it.
Yes.
Here's what I think now, Casey.
Okay.
I think the playing field has been, the door is wide open.
Yeah.
And we can kind of do whatever we want. I don't think we should stick with one filmmaker.
Sure.
What I did like about this is that it was a film I hadn't seen yet.
Yeah.
So maybe you can pick one out.
Absolutely.
Some just great film.
Yeah.
By a master.
Yeah.
That I haven't seen. And we'll just do that.
I think.
Do you have one in mind?
I have one in mind. Yeah.
What you got?
I've got Contempt by Jean-Luc Godard.
Never saw Contempt.
Perfect.
Let's do it.
Perfect.
Heard a lot about it. It's supposed to be really funny, right?
It's pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, it is actually. It's one of his funnier films,
kidding.
And I mean, just the kind of meta commentary on the film industry is great.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, I don't know much about it then.
So it's one of the classic films about filmmaking.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that at all.
Yeah. Yep.
Great. All right, Casey.
And,
we'll do
and much more than that, but yeah.
Save it. All right. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks, Chuck.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.